you will see energy bills or energy activity, legislation, policy moving, and, you know, in part because that will help address climate issues. And if you think about baseball for a moment, you've got to hit some singles and doubles to load the bases for a grand slam. So that's what legislatively people will be looking to do, to build some smaller policies up, to take the time to, you know, rebuild people's understanding of the urgency of addressing climate change, looking at the solutions. I mean, America is a totally different place in the electricity sector than it was a decade ago. And so that, you know, has to be factored in. Things are changing in the transportation sector as well. And, you know, so there has to be some education, figure out what's the most important policies to help things now going forward. And as Dean said, a lot of this will depend on how President Trump responds to what I anticipate will be some pretty vigorous oversight by Democratic chairs of his administration, and a lot on climate issues. The, you know, EPA has sort of systematically been going through Obama administration regulations to undermine them. Sometimes without a lot of reason beyond Obama administration put them in place. So so it is hard for me to see President Trump really being willing to engage in negotiations with Democrats. But he did write the art of the deal. So, and as we know, he is He put his name. He put his name on the art of the deal. How about that? He likes to say he wrote the art of the deal. And he's unpredictable. That one we can probably all agree on. Although there's some predictability to his unpredictability, but so we'll see. To Dean's question about cap and trade versus carbon tax and what might still be there. You know, I think Democrats will take a step back and just figure out what policy measures really make the most sense, either in the near term and being very pragmatic with, you know, a Republican in the White House and looking forward. So, you know, I think the biggest thing for on cap and trade, one of the most important things was just this having this environmental efficacy and knowing we're going to have a level of pollution that we're not, you know, the goal was not to go over. And I think there's still a lot of questions on the efficacy of a carbon tax. And, you know, there's starting to be some discussion about, well, what could you put on a carbon tax that maybe would kind of force a relook and like a raising of the tax if you weren't really hitting your environmental goals. So, you know, I think people, there'll be some additional kind of legislative inventiveness that helps move policies along in the next couple of years. So I think, you know, that will be something really interesting to look for. And for those of you who are feeling pressure or the desire to write some of those crystal ball stories, I would suggest to you it may be instructive to look back to 2007 and what happened then in a Democratic-controlled Congress. That Democrats did have both the House and Senate, so that may be a little different. But in 2006, Democrats ran on corruption and lowering gas prices and oil imports. And so we had a lot of oversight of the Bush administration that happened. And then in 2007, the big legislative work was an energy bill that raised fuel economy standards for the first time in 30 years, you know, put the renewable fuel standard 2.0 in place, and had some other measures. And so, they felt that was fulfilling part of what they were running on. In that 2008 time period, as Dean mentioned, I was on the Select Committee for Energy Independence and Global Warming, and our marching orders were to educate ourselves and our members and Congress and the public about the issues surrounding climate change and energy security and what policies we could put in place to do them. We didn't have a legislative mandate, but we were incredibly active, and some of that led to putting a bill together for Chairman Markey called the Investing in Climate Action and Protection Act, which he introduced in May of 2008. And having written that really helped us have a jump start in 2009 to write Waxman-Markey. So, you know, a lot of the bills and legislation that may get introduced in the next couple of years but not see a lot of movement could be important building blocks for later action. So fast forward to 2018, Democrats are running on corruption, or running against corruption, I guess, and an infrastructure bill, if you look at that, what the House is kind of, Democrats have sort of narrowed down to, and a broad piece on infrastructure. So I think in that bucket, there will be room for policies on the grid, on electric vehicles, probably on some perhaps on some climate resiliency type of things. I think drinking water infrastructure will for sure be in there, and probably in a way that's taking some of the climate change risks into account. So I will stop there and await my fellow panelists' comments and your questions.
Great. And although neither one of us has mentioned, probably we should say that there could well be a battle for House Speaker, and I'll be watching that. Be interested to see that if it's not Speaker Pelosi. You know, she was big on this issue, but I think in some ways is known as a realist, has worked as a realist in years where Democrats aren't in power. And I think, you know, we'd have to see who would take that position if she doesn't get it, how they would see this, their mandate, and it might be a different approach than hers. It might be more cautious, or it might be more aggressive. Alex is going to talk to us about what I think he hopes is going to be a growing interest in the carbon tax, particularly among the Republican Party and Republican members, which I think we all agree is probably the only way that's going to ever be accomplished legislatively. Alex Flint.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here. Very quickly, the Alliance for Market Solutions is a group of Republicans who used to run large companies. So they are the retired CEOs of State Farm, Exelon, Shell, American Enterprise Institute, United Airlines, some others. AllianceForMarketSolutions.org, if you want to see the list of who we are, since we're a relatively new organization, not trying to advertise, but that's it. I love data. So I'm going to give you some political data. I'm going to give you some fiscal data. This is polling data from pollsters we use in as of today. Since I don't know what's going to happen in the election, but it's interesting to compare this data set after the election to see which of it was relevant, which one of it drove. 40% of voters think that Trump should be impeached, 10% of Democrats, 73% of I'm sorry, 10% of Republicans, 73% of Democrats, and 32% of independents. In a generic question, do you support the incumbent or want to see somebody new? 32% want to see the incumbent returned, 53% want to see somebody new. Trump approval rating is currently at 44%, which doesn't sound great, but let me give you some comparative presidential approval at the first midterm election of their presidency. Truman, 34%, Reagan, 42%, Carter, 44%, Clinton, 44%, Obama 46%, Ford 50%, Nixon 54%. Unemployment's 3.9%. There has never been a wave election when unemployment has been above 4.4%. Okay, never been a wave election when unemployment's been this low. There is an enthusiasm gap that we're seeing. 13,600,000 Democrats voted in the primaries. Only 10,000. I'm going too fast. I'm trying to be mindful of time. Democrats voting in the primaries, 13,600,000. Republicans, 10,700,000. Generic ballot. Do you support a Republican or Democrat on the ballot, regardless of who an individual is? Democrats are plus 8, 49% to 41%. And then, if it is the economy stupid, 66% of Americans are satisfied with the economy, 34% unsatisfied. Now, I don't know what of that data we will look back at after the election and go, oh, well, of course, everybody was employed and satisfied with the Republicans so they didn't upend politics. Or, no, of course, Democrats all showed up more in the primaries and the generic ballot showed plus 8 for Democrats. Of course, there was a blue wave. No idea, but it will be very interesting to go back after the election and look. Now, let me switch a little bit. Fiscal data. The federal government collects $3.5 trillion in taxes every year and spends $4.5 trillion in taxes. That's why we have a $1 trillion a year deficit, currently at $21 trillion and growing. We have five major federal trust funds that go insolvent between 2025 and 2032. Social Security Disability, Social Security Old Age, Pension Benefits Guarantees Corporation, the Highway Trust Fund, and Medicare all go insolvent, and personal tax rates go up in 2025 already. That's the situation that we face going out in the long run. So why do I mention fiscal data in particular? Climate change is very challenging to address. It requires changing the economy in a very large scale in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to a level that are acceptable. And by the way, I don't know what acceptable is. I'm one of the ones who worries that there may not be an acceptable level going forward, given some of the trends that we're seeing. We think that whatever economic change we need to drive, we should do it as efficiently as possible and accept the sort of the economic theory that a tax is more efficient than regulation. That's a philosophical discussion. But the one thing I'd like you to take away from my remarks today is that one of the best ways to address the large-scale change in the economy that has to occur to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is not to make it just a discussion about greenhouse gas emissions. We all have seen how that plays out. We understand the politics of that. If you add the fiscal drivers into the discussion, the necessity to address shortfalls in revenue, deficits, trust fund insolvency, rising tax rates in 2025, what it does is it enables you to say the revenue off of a carbon tax can be an equal or greater motivator for addressing this problem. A reasonable carbon tax, $30 to $50 a ton, and some may say that's too high, some may say it needs to be a lot lower, higher, but $30 to $50 a ton raises $1.5 trillion over 10 years. The use of those proceeds to address fiscal issues, my contention, will be an equal or greater driver to getting a carbon tax in place to the necessity to reduce CO2 emissions. Okay. So my view is that the trump card on why we should be looking at a tax versus regulations is because regulations doesn't have that fiscal component associated with it. It simply is technically a hindrance on fiscal and GDP growth. Depending upon what you do with the revenues of a carbon tax, you can address fiscal issues. You can create a second incentive for addressing this great problem.
Great. Thank you, Alex. My next speaker is Jennifer Haverkamp, and unfortunately, I left Jennifer to carry a lot of the weight on where we are on international climate. But I did want us to speak to that because the continued U.S. participation, future U.S. participation, or return to the table is something we're constantly thinking about in the climate world. So, Jennifer, you have the floor. Actually, just the three of us had the United States, and I put the entire international load on you.
Okay. You're like Atlas. You've got to carry the world.
Well, Fortunately, the rest of the world is really trying to continue to address this issue, as our states, as our localities, even if our federal government isn't doing that much. I thought I'd talk about the three international climate agreements that Dean mentioned at the beginning, the Paris Agreement and its implementation, but also say a little bit about the Montreal Protocol Agreement and the Aviation Agreement, because all three of them have some important deadlines coming up the end of 2018 and early 2019. First is the Paris Agreement. Its implementation continues, as you probably know. There's an annual conference of the parties every year in December. This year it will be in, help me with the pronunciation, Katowice, Poland, December 3 through 14. And it's a quite important year for implementation of the Paris Agreement. In Marrakesh in 2016, during and after the U.S. election, the governments gave themselves this 2018 meeting as the deadline for completing the rule book for implementing the Paris Agreement. So they have been working for the last 2 years on trying to write up these rules. And there are quite a few significant issues in the rule book. It includes the whole issue of transparency. What kind of monitoring, what kind of reporting do countries have to do on how they're fulfilling their nationally determined contributions under the agreement? What kind of contributions they're making on the adaptation side, climate finance? There is built into the Paris Agreement something called the global stock taking. Given that everyone recognizes that the commitments that were made at Paris do not get us to 2 degrees of warming, much less 1.5 degrees of warming, the parties built in ways to try to create greater incentive to make their contributions more ambitious. And so this global stock taking is starting in 2023, and every 5 years thereafter, they collectively take stock of how are we doing toward getting to that goal, including the agreement's goal of basically carbon neutrality by 2050, that sinks and emissions match up by 2050. So they were trying to develop rules for this global stock taking. And then another really important aspect of the meeting in December is that the parties need to take consideration of and discuss this special report that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is coming out with. And one way that they are going to do that, which was agreed last year, is by something called the Talanoa Dialogue, which is the parties sitting down together at very high level, like their ministers who come to the meeting, and have a discussion of what the IPCC report's results mean for the chance to meet the obligations under the agreement. How are we doing on that? Not a lot of progress. I say there's quite a bit of concern about completing this successfully by December. They had their annual mid-year meeting in May, and it made little progress, so they agreed to have a special session added to the calendar, and that was earlier in September in Bangkok, September 4th through 9th. They had a special negotiating session, and because there aren't enough acronyms to go around in the climate world, there's another one you might hear, which is PAWP, P-A-W-P, which stands for the Paris Agreement Work Program. So that's what we're doing. We're doing the PAWP by the COP.
Is that like walking in the park when you're in Boston?
Yeah. It would be very good for people from Boston to talk about this stuff. Good
yeah.
point. And again, why has this been difficult? Why will this be difficult? Among other things, of course, there's the fact that the United States is not leading the charge as we have done so many times in the past. But also, there are a couple chronic issues that are always there and are quite sharp this year as well, which is in these implementation rules, do developed countries and developing countries have the same obligations? If not, how do you take into account those differences? And the biggest challenge always is, in which of those baskets, if you have such baskets, do you put China? because the main concern for the United States has always been that China, as the world's largest emitter, really needs to be, in many ways, treated the same as countries like the U.S. China, it's very important to them to continue to be identified as a developing country, and so that's been a very long-standing argument in these negotiations, and you'll probably see some of that as well. And then another one is on climate finance, and I'll say a little bit more about that. So things that are going to happen so between now and the COP in December, I mentioned the IPCC's special report. That is actually supposed to be finalized right now this week. They're working on it in Korea. It's supposed to come out late Sunday night, East Coast time. There's controversy around that because somebody leaked the U.S. negotiating instructions where the U.S. negotiators were supposed to raise lots of questions about the justifications and the adequacy of the science behind this special report. And, you know, I think the people who are writing this report are concerned because as scientists, they've been given a very short deadline. 2 years is a very short deadline, frankly, to generate something with real credibility in that area. So, but it's we'll see where that comes out. Then, like usual, in late October, there will be political-level discussions amongst the parties to try to prepare for the final ministerial, and then you'll have the COP in December. One question people often ask is, okay, if President Trump has announced that the U.S. is pulling out, who's the U.S. negotiating team? Are they trying? Are they just sitting there saying nothing? And I would say the good news for the United States' long-term interests is that senior, experienced U.S. negotiators continue to run this process. And the leader of that group is Trigg Talley, who also was doing this work for the George W. Bush administration as well, so he's got a lot of continuity. And many of these issues, as I've described, shouldn't be that political within the United States because they're about rules about transparency, things where if the United States stays in the agreement or ever rejoins the agreement, we would want those rules to be strong and fair and not advantage some countries over others. So I would expect those people go there. I have no idea who the administration might send from a political perspective. The political person they sent last year, George David Banks, you may recall, mm-hmm. left the White House in February. So we'll see who they send. But the other thing that makes this difficult is the State Department doesn't put environmental issues very high on their priority list right now. And they still have not even nominated someone to be Assistant Secretary for Environment, and they abolished the special representative, the special envoy position on climate change. And the wonderful, dedicated civil servant, or rather foreign service senior officer who has been running that Bureau of the State Department for 4.5 years now, has finally been named or nominated to be the ambassador to Cyprus. So she will be gone, probably, or maybe by then, or maybe not by then. So there are real questions about, even at the career level, who the very senior U.S. leadership would be at a meeting where usually you have a lot of countries sending, if not ministers, mm-hmm. sometimes heads of state. So I mentioned that finance is often an issue. Another thing that will probably make negotiations in November difficult is that the Green Climate Fund, which is this fund that was set up to help developing countries adapt to and mitigate their emissions, isn't going very well. Part of it is that of the United States' $3 billion pledge, Obama got $1 billion out the door before the end of his administration, and Trump has announced the U.S. won't contribute anything else. At a meeting of the Green Climate Fund this summer, there was such disagreement amongst the parties that they couldn't agree to add any new projects to the list to be funded. So there will be a lot of frustration on the part of developing countries around the finance issues. Since we're supposed to try to speculate about what might happen with a midterm elections, on the Green Climate Fund, I don't know, but there's a there's a chance that funding for that might at least get to the White House if the Democrats control the House. Last year in 2017, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed an amendment that Senator Merkley put forward to put Green Climate Fund funding into the budget. And that included votes from not only Susan Collins, you would expect, but also Lamar Alexander. So, you know, if the House puts it in, there it might get out of committee in the Senate, and then who knows whether it would stay in the full Senate. And then you've got the question of, would that really be what would be put on the veto threat list? Who knows? So the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, hoping you know what it is. The Montreal Protocol is the agreement to try to keep the ozone layer in place, and it's been an extremely successful agreement. In 2016, countries added an amendment to phase down the use of hydrofluorocarbons, which are hugely potent greenhouse gas. The expectation is that implementation of this agreement could avoid up to half a degree of global warming this century, which is a very big deal. And this agreement, every other amendment that has been done to the Montreal Protocol, the United States has taken to the Senate for advice and consent as a treaty amendment. And so that is probably, if the Trump administration decides they want to join this amendment, they will probably go through Senate advice and consent. What's interesting about this one is it has very strong industry support. Industry is actually leading the effort to get the U.S. to ratify this amendment. And so if it doesn't go forward, it's because of decisions made within the administration, I would say, rather than problems in the Senate. And that is in part because the expectation as the world gets hotter, as the developing world gets wealthier, as the population grows, demand for air conditioning and refrigeration is going to grow enormously. And U.S. companies want to be the ones providing those the alternative chemicals and also the appliances that would use those. So you have the administration saying, well, what will this do for the economy? And the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute put out a big report on all the positive aspects for the U.S. economy that this would produce. So I won't go into the details of what it says unless you ask me to, but you have a lot of Republican senators supporting this going forward. So watch that space. If they do decide to do it, people at some point had thought they might do it during a lame duck. Now I think they've got other priorities, and again, the problem of a kind of gap in leadership at the State Department, who you would expect to lead this effort. So it may not be until the next year or so, but I mentioned deadlines. The first obligation for countries who are parties to that agreement comes in 2019. So the U.S. can play catch-up and join later, but that's coming up.
And Jennifer, I want to come back to you because I want to get audience questions in at this point because
okay.
We'll be low on time. But I at some point we'll come back around and hopefully mention ICAO
okay.
and the aviation agreement, which is sort of like the third leg to
sure.
these efforts.
Sounds good.
But I do want to get some questions in. So if you can keep your questions relatively short, because I have to put them right back into the mic for the recording. So less is more. I'll go with this gentleman here.
All the Republican co-sponsors of climate legislation in the current Congress are backing a carbon tax.
So let me just repeat the question.
Oh,
so the
sorry.
Question is, what's the constituency? Hold on for just a second. What's the constituency, the political constituency, and the backing for a carbon tax? And how are you going to get rank and file Republicans to support it?
So I think it's very important to recognize that there has not been a Republican climate bill for a decade until Curbelo, Fitzpatrick, and Rooney introduced a carbon tax bill. I believe that represents a very important evolution in the discussion. Without a doubt, the Scalise resolution was an effort to sabotage the support for carbon tax. I think it was done by opponents of a carbon tax who recognized that there was momentum building for it. And I realize that we are in the early days. But in our conversations with Republicans, very few of them deny the science of climate change. What they struggle with is what they as conservatives can do about it that's consistent with their values. And they struggle with regulations that they have criticized for their entire careers. A tax, particularly one that's used to reduce other taxes, because it has a fiscal component, they can come to understand is more appealing and consistent with their values. Now, they're afraid of it. If they've got Republican primaries and they're worried about it being challenged from the right, there's no question. But if you accept, as I do, that inevitably we have to do something, and you look at both the climate drivers and you look at the fiscal drivers, I think it's inevitable that we go down this path. If you assume that we are going to have to do something and it's really a question of picking what, I will tell you that today the outlook for a carbon tax is better among Republicans than the outlook for cap and trade.
I'm going to just a quick housekeeping measure. So I'm supposed to ask questions to priority four SEJ journalists. So throw up your arms now if you fit that category and you are interested in asking a question, and then throw up your question. Throw up your arm extra high when I get to you right after I ask Carolyn Wetzel.
Okay, Carolyn Wetzel, now an independent journalist. My question is for Alex. Having heard a lot of the debate about carbon tax versus cap and trade in California, when it comes to if you're successful in getting a carbon tax, isn't there going to be a lot of debate and disagreement on how to spend that money and whether or not that money should be spent to reduce emissions versus reduce deficits in various other programs?
So Carolyn's question is, given the debate in California on the cap and trade system there, how essentially will we resolve the issue of the use of revenues, and perhaps why not use some of those revenues to further drive down emissions?
So I think your point is well taken. I think it's also one of the real challenges about the referendum in Washington State right now. My counsel to people is that we need to build more momentum for the notion of a carbon tax before we start fighting over the use of the proceeds. But I do recognize that what you've raised is a challenge. In the end, I believe politicians are sufficiently interested in spending money that they will come up, they will accept the necessary carbon tax to generate the revenue.
Can I add to that?
Please.
So I think it's your question is right on the money. At first, no pun intended, but that was pretty good, right? That's the big question. And I also agree with Alex that, you know, that's a hard one for Republicans, and they need to build some support for the theory. But how you spend the money can really impact ultimately the carbon reductions you get from your tax. So there's a REGI, the Northeast states are actually a great experiment in what happens when you spend the money differently, because each state decided what to do with it. So Massachusetts, which I know the best, funneled it all largely back into energy efficiency work and some renewables work, and saw a commiserately higher economic benefit to their state economy. Places like Delaware is, I think, a good contrast, has an existential threat from rising sea levels. I mean, Massachusetts has a problem there, too. But they invested a lot of their money in sort of adaptation measures and coastal protection, which is also important, but is harder to, like, calculate the economics on. So, you know, that people really care also about how the money is spent. And I think I also agree with Alex that it was a huge step forward for the Republican members to introduce their climate bill. And, you know, they did shift the gas tax as part of, or how you finance the highway trust fund. But they really talk about it as investing in infrastructure. And so, you know, I think that's kind of an equally important part of the conversation and a data point that when currently elected Republican officials put forward a bill, they really focused on investment in real things, tangible things that the American public could really understand.
And we're going to go to Alondo Cooper here in a second, but I recall when I was working on this bill on cap and trade, one of the big debates was how much money they were going to have to shovel at coal to get coal on the bill. And I think one of the questions that I hear, if you talk to former Chairman Waxman now or Mr. Markey, you'll hear them talk about whether coal is ever going to get a deal like that again. And so when we start talking about revenues, you know, there's this pent-up feeling that they went the extra mile because there is this revenue in either a cap and trade or carbon tax. And I think it was a little, in a sense, it was sort of old-fashioned politicking. Like if we separate this money and we put it in all the right pots, everybody will go along in the end. And there's some pent-up resentment, I think, about what was on the table and what they turned down. And the phrase that Waxman will tell you is they're never going to get that deal again. Now whether that's a bluster or whether they're going to have to put some deal in order to get coal or not, remains to be seen, but it tells you the enormous impact that what the decisions with revenue could have or might not be able to put you across the line, depending on the politics of it. Alondo Cooper. So the question from Avlando was, given, I guess, the U.S. withdrawal and what we're seeing in terms of negotiations in Paris, what has been the harm that has been done, and how do we sort of has there harm been done in the negotiations under Trump's negotiators?
That's a great question. I would say a couple things. One is that at one level you could say not yet that much harm, because the U.S. isn't out yet. And given the rules of that agreement, this president can announce that the U.S. is pulling out, and the next president, just a couple months later, could rejoin. However, I think what I was saying about the Green Climate Fund and the concerns around the will of countries like the United States to help fund developing countries' addressing of the problem has been hurt, and that will make the negotiations of these other rules and things more complicated. I think the other thing is that while you have the senior negotiators at the table with their expertise, what you don't have necessarily behind them, as you had in the Obama administration, is the full force of the U.S. government trying to achieve these outcomes. Like when you look at getting the Paris Agreement to enter into force in 2016, that was an all-out effort by the National Security Council, by the President, by the Secretary of State. Everybody was using all the U.S. diplomatic leverage to make that happen. And so for, you know, ambition in these negotiations, you're not going to see that coming from the U.S. And the European Union is trying to kind of fill that role. But their situation is somewhat complicated. China is presenting itself as kind of the new leader on climate change, but they're very resistant on things like transparency. So having them as in the driver's seat on some of these rules won't get you quite the same outcome you would have gotten otherwise.
And I had a follow-up. Jennifer, I did want to ask this because we were fascinated with this story in the first year of the Trump administration was, you know, would there be this window for reconsideration of the withdrawal of the U.S. under Trump? In other words, is there some magic formula, some circumstances that could arise that you would foresee the U.S. somehow for Trump to essentially remove his withdrawal notice? Or do you think that we have sort of seen that Linus and Lucy and or, you know, Charlie Brown football trick too many times, and people keep talking about it could happen. Are we done with the idea that Trump could rethink this, or is there some way he could?
I think until the very end of these 4 years, he could. And I think that he's often in his statements said things that hold the door open to reopening if it could be somehow, in his mind, seen as a better deal for the United States. And frankly, if you look at the no longer called NAFTA agreement that they just came out with, it doesn't necessarily take a lot substantively to change for it to be rebranded in a way that he will claim as a success. So I'm not going to be Pollyanna on this, but I don't think the window is closed on that question.
I was just going to say, I think the flip side, though, is also important in that a lot of the leaders who would have to go along with that are just fed up with him. I mean, like, it's hard to see European leaders or even President Xi, like, being willing to do that. I mean, Canada and Mexico had, like, real economic reasons to figure it out.
They're not going to want to reopen very much,
yeah.
If anything. It'll have to be more additive.
Yeah, and part of that also was, I don't know if we've mentioned this, but the whole idea behind the architecture of the Paris Agreement was essentially a U.S. idea. So it's sort of like coming to a club and saying, like, we're going to create this entire, you know, card game. You'll have it at my house. We'll do it under these all rules. And then you say, I'm out, but I'll come back. Actually, we have to change the whole idea of the card game. I want totally different rules. It's a little different than NAFTA, where they all kind of gave, and the U.S. gave up some things it didn't want to give in NAFTA and got some things in the original agreement. In this case, the rest of the world was sort of beat over the head that its approach of having a binding deal was never going to work and that the U.S. had a better approach, and it used other negotiating teams to put that idea on the table. But it's essentially a U.S.-designed deal, so I don't think the rest of the world wants to sit down and be told now or lectured that it was a terrible idea and there's a new idea in town.
There's two questions like that one.
Hands high for SEJ members. Stretch it out. Put them behind. Okay. In the very back. So this is a question about, in terms of the other negotiating parties. So are other countries embracing or even stepping into the void somehow and using this as an opportunity, in a sense, from the Paris withdrawal?
I think they're trying to fill the void, but they're not relishing it. And the, you know, I remember the incredible standing ovations that Obama administration officials got at the beginning of that administration when the other countries felt like the U.S. was finally back at the table rowing in the same direction, when they felt like the George W. Bush administration hadn't been as supportive. And so I think other countries would really rather have the U.S. trying to be ambitious with them. And, you know, in Marrakesh, right after the election, every U.S. negotiator was getting hugs from everybody. You know, the other countries would rather have the U.S. there with them.
And I think one thought that I don't have an answer for this quite yet, but I also think we haven't quite figured out what the trajectory is for the history of international agreements, where we have a number of whether you support the administration or not, the simple act of abandoning negotiations that have been negotiated by your predecessor, by the U.S. government. You know, it's actually the day after the next election is when the U.S. can go back into the Paris Agreement, theoretically. Of course, the person needs to be president at that point. But, you know, on the environmental side of that, I think that's hailed as, you know, a great opportunity for us to be back at the table. But you can also already see this sort of whipsaw impact where negotiators on different agreements around the world are going to be saying, how's this new scenario work where, okay, so you're back. Are you back for a couple years or the next person comes in? Because there's this question of continuity of international agreements that's been raised. And I think other governments are probably watching that. And Trump isn't the only, you know, world leader to come in the years to come. I think someone's going to adopt this as perhaps their argument for national election someday. And this is the beginning of something that I don't think we know how it's going to play out exactly.
Could I comment on that? Mm-hmm. Just briefly, I think that's right, but and the U.S. is always a unique player, but it's not an unprecedented situation. I mean, countries have been whipsawed by Australia
who kept changing governments and being pro and anti and pro and anti-climate, and even Canada, who right now is really one of the ones trying to fill the vacuum and a very positive leader on climate in those negotiations, Canada pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol. And so, you know, the system can accommodate countries as they change positions. What I worry about more is just overall confidence in U.S. leadership on the diplomatic front, not only because of pulling out of Paris, but after the whole Trans-Pacific Partnership was our idea and the U.S. pulled out.
I'll take another question, and I have a question also for Alex, so I'm going to take this question. This would be a good question for, I guess I'll start with Alex. What about this idea of a blue wave maybe decimating the Republican members of the caucus and how important, or do you even foresee that happening at this point, looking at some of the poll numbers, and what would be the implications of that?
Oh, I'm very worried about that. I think that in part, Republicans in districts that are experiencing climate effects have been some of the first to reconsider Republican climate orthodoxy, if you will, because they're paying a lot of attention to their constituents. I think that's one of the reasons that you see Floridians, I would say, overrepresented in the Climate Solutions Caucus. I think there's 9 of them of both parties in the Climate Solutions Caucus. And I think that's definitely one of the things that motivates, I mean, Curbelo and Rooney's districts are the very southern tip of Florida to be involved. Curbelo's race is a toss-up. What we're trying to do, frankly, is we're very closely following that race, and what we hope to be able to show afterwards is that win or lose, that because he has supported addressing climate, he overperforms the spread. But just the fact that I'm worried about the spread as much as I'm worried about what the outcome is tells you. There will be a lot of turnover on the Climate Solutions Caucus. There already is, just because of retirements, and I think the caucus is going to have to decide what they want to do going forward. Like, do they keep the 1-1 ratio if a bunch of Republicans aren't there anymore? And so I think it's a very legitimate question. I'm concerned about it. Don't have a good answer for you.
And before I go to the next question, I'm just curious, how many people have voted or are going to vote in the midterm election in the audience? Either you voted or you're going to vote. So I think these numbers, like, that sort of tells you, you know, I think that's pretty much what we're going to see in the country, by the way, a 90% turnout rate. I mean, it sort of tells you, like, we're in rarefied air, right? We're here. We're among people who follow these things. And I think as a voter, you know, if you went into Curbelo, or another person I'm watching is Mia Love in Utah and forth, you know, I did a story that mentioned her, and environmental groups were noting her attempts to touch on membership in the climate caucus, et cetera. She was seen as a relatively safe Republican-leaning seat. Toss-up. So they're moving into seats in Utah where they expect this to change. And what I wonder is, you know, you're all probably seeing this through an environmental lens like I do, and might have even heard of a climate caucus in the House. But if you're a member, or if you're a voter in one of these districts, you know, I think about how much far I'd have to drill down, how many stories I would have to read to get exposed to or hear the right ad, to hear that climate connection made, then feed into my decision-making, oh, I like that about who was that, and then also put it back into the equation of, but how do I feel about Republicans right now, right? And at the end of that, spit out a pro-Curbelo vote so that I can say, you know, so we can save this bipartisan effort, because I think at the end it might make a difference. You know, and that's the part that I was asking some staff a couple weeks ago, what happens to the climate caucus? And the mumbling on the Democratic side is, chances are it's probably going to go away. You know, there's some resentment, if I'm hearing this right, resentment about the feeling that it's not helping Democrats. It's helping Republican and Democrat efforts to work together.
But whether this is fair or not, and I think there's an argument it's not fair to Republicans, a lot of Democrats are coming to power and say, we're here to do something about the problem, not to have a group that we necessarily meet with. And I think it'll be interesting to see who are the members that say, actually, this is valuable, because ultimately we can talk all day about getting back in the Paris Agreement. We could talk about passing a carbon tax or cap and trade. But if this is viewed as a partisan effort by some future administration, we're going to be right back to where we were on Obamacare. You have to find a way, which is why I find Alex's group interesting on this question, is you have to find a way. It might seem impossible to get Republicans onto this issue and any numbers that are going to make it appear bipartisan. But if you don't, how do you construct lasting climate policy on the backs of one party? Because we were there after, you can debate a lot about what happened to people who voted for cap and trade, but there were a lot of moderate efforts, moderate Democrats took a hit. And even the moderate Republicans, the eight that voted, I think, for cap and trade, how many of those were gone after Election Day? A lot of them. More than half of them.
Yeah, their numbers are dwindling, but it wasn't immediate.
So fine, and it's a and that's an uphill battle when it's not like just convincing a one political party of the benefits, of the economic benefits to the economy, or the problem of climate change, but to overcome, it's become part of that party's real sense of. It's like a club about not saying things about climate change or not speaking proactively about climate change now, to the degree that that's going to have to shift, I think, for us to have a lasting resolution of this. And the only way to do that, I think, is, when you think about that, what drives that shift? Is it Republicans finally, wising up and deciding they've learned about climate change? I think it probably has more to do with voters deciding to reward Republicans who recognize climate change, because I don't think there's no aha moment for politicians to say, I've been wrong all along. I can't believe I've been so wrong on this problem. I see it now. You show me the data. I don't know that's going
to
be the change.
I'm going to disagree with you, Dean. As a proud AGU member, longtime AGU member, a bunch of the Republicans who are active on climate change, especially from Florida, have changed their mind because of the data, and the data is flooding on a sunny day when it's high tide. I mean, they are seeing, and then it's like, what's going on here? And then they recognize, okay, well, we can't just like have enough pumps and have enough, raise stuff enough to do something. So you are right. It is hard for a politician to change a position or take a different vote unless they have a really good reason. But when their communities and their economies of their communities are threatened by something beyond what they can control in that locality, they change their view. I want to also underscore the real importance of how people interpret the results for the Safe Climate Caucus Republicans, or their seats, sort of dependent. There are a number of them that are retiring, so they're open seats. And there absolutely will be people who are opponents of taking action on climate change who will do their utmost to spin losses and point the finger at their climate change stance. And you can see Alex is maybe already thinking about how to be able to talk, smartly about that. We had it with Waxman Markey. Dean just sort of said it again. There are a lot of people that tried to point the finger at Democrats who lost their seats in 2010 as because of their vote on cap and trade. I argue that signal is not as strong, as clear, probably, as some opponents of action would try to make it. There were a lot of votes, healthcare, Recovery Act, that added up. But I mean, it certainly, what really motivated the voter is one question, and what the perception was is another, and certainly that perception is there and could set back climate policy. I mean, if people win the spin war on why some of these Republicans lose their seat, I mean, I'm worried about that too for climate policy, because I mean, we do need Republican support. We do need bipartisan support to move all types of climate policy forward. So,
Jennifer, do you want to add something?
Very briefly, agreeing with you, and part of it is that I think a lot of the people who do surveys feel like no matter how many people say they really care about climate change, it seldom rises to be one of the top issues they vote on, either in favor of a politician. So to me, it would be also, it's probably not the top reason they vote against a politician in very many circumstances.
I want to respond to that. I've got a poll right now, incumbent Republican, member of the Climate Solutions Caucus, 35-35. Of the 30% undecided, a willingness to address climate is the greatest potential beneficial differentiator, plus 70 minus 6. Right? So what we're trying to do is go to Republicans and say, yeah, I know it doesn't work very well in your primary, but it does work in your general. I'll conclude with just a pleading more than an observation. If we agree that we really need to solve climate at scale for the duration, our contention is we need both parties involved. It is understandable that climate can be made a political weapon right now in politics, and I understand how Republicans are particularly vulnerable to that right now. As I talk to Republicans, a lot of their principal experience has been Democrats beating them up over the climate issue. It has been a political tool. It needs to become a political challenge, not a political tool. And I say that not in an accusatory way, but just as a statement that we have to somehow make it safe for Republicans to take initial steps to join the Climate Solutions Caucus, even if it doesn't take any action, but at least because they recognize they need a fig leaf on this issue. As somebody told me once, people look for fig leaves only after they recognize they're naked, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a step, even if they don't know what they're doing. So there's a lot. I mean, this is a great bar conversation later on, but I'd be glad.
Alex just apparently offered to buy. We got the rare additional five-minute granting from the powers that be at SEJ. I think those powers that be are in another room looking over this now, godlike, right? Is that how it works? I always like to go to questions when I get extra time. I'm really big on questions. Journalists with questions. Okay, SEJ members, raise them high.
I was a panelist.
Okay, panelist works for me.
I'm a researcher.
Okay.
I can talk from my recollection of other people's work, which is really a totally dangerous thing to do. All you journalists in here, take it. Give me a grain of salt here. There has been a number of polling. Ed Maybach from George Mason was in one of the earlier sessions. I think George Mason and Yale worked together on a bunch of climate-focused polling, and I think they've looked at this. John Krosnick, I think I'm saying that right, in Stanford Woods Institute has also looked at this. And what my recollection is, which was basically my takeaway from my work, was those people immediately impacted don't, because they're like, how do I get the lights on? How do I get, you know, the mud out of my house? And it's more, what's more interesting is how it sort of geographically then is recognized and impacted. And so it's sort of people then in not impacted, but near, kind of like, that's interesting. But that, as I recall, that fades pretty quickly. It's hard to take a kind of natural disaster type of event and underscore it. Some of it maybe you have the litany. There was Harvey. Now this year there was Florence. You know, kind of thing that can build up. There were wildfires in California, and we also the other interest. Krosnick did one sort of right after Sandy, and as I recall, like it was a big issue and got a lot of media play because obviously one of the major media centers of America was hit. But like out on the West Coast, it's like, oh yeah, there's something happening, like out on the East Coast, you know. Whereas in the East, it felt like, oh my God, this is a huge story. So
I'll take this question.
It's kind of a follow-up to that for Alex again, which is that do you think, again, your constituency, Republicans, are more open to the conversation if you just leapfrog to adaptation? I mean, like, the Interior Department has renamed four research centers climate change centers, and they're now calling them climate adaptation centers.
So the question, to do this right, is are Republicans more willing to talk about adaptation?
I think that Republicans are looking for safe space in this conversation. Actually, that term has all sorts of meanings. I'm not sure. It has meaning I don't understand. So I don't want to take it back. Republicans are exploring this issue. Like, they're willing to support 45Q, which is tax credit for carbon sequestration. Many of them, without saying it's because of climate, but you wonder why is it, right? Some of them are willing to talk about adaptation. So I think what you're seeing, I believe that politicians learn through conversations with other people. First in small groups, like when I go in and have a conversation with them, then they'll bounce it off their campaign advisors, then they'll bring it up maybe in a town hall meeting, they'll see how it goes, and then finally they've become comfortable enough with this conversation, they understand the political ramifications, they'll propose something. I think what you're seeing with the willingness to discuss adaptation is exploring what is safe for them to discuss. And I think some people look at it and say, well, it's inadequate. And I say, I actually think it's indicative of a nascent effort.
Contractually obligated to remind you can follow our staff's work. There's 12 of us for Bloomberg Environment in Washington. Twitter account is at Bloomberg Env, as in ENV, because, you know, we just can't get away from an acronym like. I'm at Dean T. Scott. If you want to follow my stuff, because our stuff goes outside the paywall via Twitter most often. So if I have any last thoughts, Anna or Jennifer, Alex,
thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Alex Flint. I'm gonna remind all of you of these groups because they're really good to follow. And Jennifer's job is a new one, so I'm really interested in what the University of Michigan's Graham Sustainability Institute, what she's going to be bringing to that. Alex, the American Market Solutions, if they're going to be talking about the carbon tax, I would call them. He's been around a long time. We didn't talk a lot about his days in Congress, but he's seen how the mechanics of this work. And if it gets to after Election Day, talk to Anna. Anna's at Unroe Cohen is at NRDC, and she actually talks to reporters. Rumors have it she talked to a reporter last night at a bar here in Flint.
I know.
It wasn't reported, but...
And without my communications colleague, Josh, back in the...
Right, exactly.
So introduce yourself to Josh, too.
She may have talked on background, but I don't understand what those terms mean, the whole background off-the-record issue, so the split there. So thanks, everyone, for coming, and look forward to seeing you next year in Colorado.